Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. In 25 minutes, call your friends and neighbors. Wilkin is going to talk about public schools. A change of mind I've had of late. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. He joins us here for this next 25 minutes to talk about the influence of Christianity on science. He has written this book called How Christianity Changed the World. Well, it was a couple of years ago when it first came out under the title Under the Influence. We did a 15-part series with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, and one of the subjects we dealt with was the sciences. He is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College, and a little bit later in our conversation I'll tell you about him as one of the speakers at a Confessional Christian Worldview seminar this summer at the Schwann Center in northern Wisconsin. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, the rap that is often laid at the doorstep of Christianity is that it has been historically anti-science. Is this true?
No, it's very false, and in fact is one of the myths that most people today tend to think and believe, and they pick it up in various contexts, and high school and college and the like. The very opposite is true. My book has a whole chapter devoted to it, and I title it Science, Its Christian Connections. Now, science, modern science, empirical, inductive methodology, which is what is the essence of science, began in the 13th century with notable Christians like Robert Gostesti, a first chancellor of Oxford University, his student by the name of Roger Bacon. Both of these argued that knowledge should be obtained by the empirical inductive method as opposed to the old Aristotelian way of thinking where knowledge was derived at by deductive method, or often called armchair reasoning, rather than going out into the world of matter and observing and studying and analyzing it. This all began with these men that I mentioned. It wasn't only Roger Bacon or Gostesti, but it was also people like Francis Bacon, who came roughly 150 years later, who gave further momentum to the inductive method by actually recording experimental results. And he has often been called the practical creator of the scientific induction. Then you have William Ockham, for example, who basically gave science what is often called Ockham's razor. In other words, take that explanation, it is the simplest if it yields the same outcome or results. And Christianity also really brought science into being, because previous to that you had Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, whose views basically held sway for 1,500 years, which I said was the deductive method, but underlying his thought was, for example, pantheism. Pantheism is a term meaning that God is in everything and everything is God, and including the stones, the trees, and what have you, animate and inanimate objects are all basically containing in some way some divine spirit. And Aristotle even argued that planets, although they moved, and he knew they did, but they had an inner intelligence, an anima, as the Latins would call it, that induced them to move. And so his whole way of thinking was something that Christianity bringing into play, namely that the God was a rational being who created the world for us to study in a rational way. And so you have Alfred Northhead White, a very famous philosopher of science, and by the way, not a Christian, to my knowledge, as far as I know, he was an atheist, who said, for example, it was the insistence on the rationality of God, which Christianity brought into being, that made science possible. He also said faith in the possibility of science, generated antecedently to the development of modern scientific theory, is an unconscious derivative from medieval theology. He's talking about Christian theology again in the 12th, 13th, 14th century.
Now, how is it then that what we just mentioned here, the fact that many believe Christianity has been historically opposed to all scientific efforts, all scientific discoveries, this is what we hear so often. How did that notion come to be so popular?
Well, that's a very good question. I think one has to trace it back to a publication that was made in 1896 by White, a professor and president of Cornell University, who wrote two particular volumes about the conflict or the warfare between Christian theology and science. And it seems like since then, everyone has picked it up. And when one looks at that particular work, the two-volume work, it is full of error and fallacies and false thinking, and that somehow has become the belief. In addition to that, about, oh, maybe 30, 40, 50 years before that, you might say, scientists began to adopt what is often called methodological atheism. Some call it philosophical materialism. In other words, divorced from any kind of relationship to God or the divine. On the other hand, it overlooks these men that I mentioned, but I could mention many others. For example, Kepler, Copernicus, Newton, Pascal, Robert Boyle, from whom we get Boyle's Law, Paracelsus, Pasteur, and all these men were very devout Christians and tried to understand the world of science that they were studying in terms of God's explanation. They tried to, in other words, incorporate into their theory the biblical Christian perspective, again showing that they operated very differently than when later on, sort of around 1800, the methodological materialism, or atheism as it's sometimes called, began to take hold. And then you had this book written by White, Andrew Dixon White, at Cornell, or two actually, and Christianity has been seen as the enemy of science when it isn't. You know, what about Kepler, who gave science the first three scientific laws? Was a devout Lutheran, only about 4 months shy of being ordained as a Lutheran pastor, died as a devout Lutheran, and argued, you know, I'm not playing around with God, but rather trying to reveal what God has given us. And then you have, like, Pasteur, a couple of hundred years later, a devout Christian who gave us the insight in terms of bacteria, and whose name we've used in terms of the pasteurization process. When he died, he had a crucifix in one hand and his wife's hand in the other hand. And all of these guys, when you read them, left many statements behind indicating their Christian convictions and did not see science as an antithesis to Christianity, but something that Christianity could help them understand God's created world.
The story is typically told, and you mentioned him before, but I want you to go in a little more detail, about Nicholas Copernicus, the so-called Copernican Revolution, mm-hmm. That, you know, here was this guy who figured out through the methods of observation that the Earth was not the center of the universe, but in fact the Earth went around the sun. He proposed this model. He was branded as a heretic by the church because Christianity opposes all scientific progress. Tell us the real story about Copernicus and his revolution.
Yeah, and that's another, you know, misstatement. He was persecuted, if you will, by the Roman Catholic Church. He was not persecuted by the Protestants and primarily the Lutherans. Let's not forget that a Lutheran mathematician from the University of Wittenberg went to his hometown, Copernicus, in the Torun area, western Poland, and for 2 years helped him on his major work of the revolution of the heavenly bodies. And Copernicus is often called a timid canon. He was very reluctant because he knew he was going to be criticized not by the church primarily, but by fellow scientists. Nevertheless, the publication was put into play by not only, for example, Radicus the mathematician helping him, but also by the fact that Osiander, a Lutheran pastor in Nuremberg, wrote the introduction to that particular work, and Duke Albrecht financed it in order to have it published. Now, these were all prominent Lutherans, so when we hear that Copernicus was persecuted, they forget to mention that it was his own Catholic Church. It was not the Protestant world, in this case the Lutherans, and then later on in England, for example, it was the Puritans, for the most part, that formed the Royal Society, which is still the most prestigious scientific organization to this day. All that is ignored, never known perhaps, and so what we get often in science books is total misinformation, and I often say a little bit of knowledge, which is an old saying, is a dangerous thing. And it's very dangerous here because people tend to think Christianity is an enemy of science. No, it never was. It actually started it and complimented it.
Is it true that Martin Luther referred to Copernicus as a fool?
Well, that is often mentioned. The only place that, first of all, there are a couple of problems with that. Luther never, he makes a statement about a fool, but he never mentions Copernicus' particular name. Moreover, this is only found in his table talks, which come roughly about 150 years, but were edited by people who heard him speak. It's seen as a very unreliable scientific particular work, namely the table talks. So he may have said that. He may have had him in mind. At the same time, we have to remember that 1549, only a few years after Luther died, Philip Melanchthon, a close colleague of Luther, whom Luther used a great deal, said, I begin to appreciate Copernicus more and more. Now, that's the first time that I know that Lutherans mentioned him, and it was in a positive light. So that other statement is really highly dubious, and it's in a lot of books, but any good scholar should never cite it, because, first of all, we don't know whether Luther had Copernicus in mind, and secondly, we don't know whether even that statement without his name is even accurate, because of the editing process that took place 150 years after Luther died.
We're talking about the influence of Christianity on science. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. In about 15 minutes, open lines for your thoughts on Christian children attending public schools. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Schmidt, another one, a very famous name in science, of course, is Galileo.
Mm-hmm.
And you point out, and I found this very interesting, that the reason Galileo ran afoul of his Roman Catholic superiors had less to do with their adherence to the Bible's view of the world as to Aristotle's view of the world. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's quite right. You see, this was the thing, you know, and there were guys besides, the Catholics that sort of persecuted him, that still believe that the Aristotelian view that I mentioned earlier, that the world should be understood or knowledge can only be derived by deductive reasoning. And, of course, the empirical inductive method was very much, polar opposite, you might even say. And so these people were still tied to the Aristotelian method. And that's largely why they condemned him. But even there, that case is often overstated because, you know, it didn't burn him at the stake and the like. But it also makes the point that I mentioned earlier. It was the Catholics that had more problem with the signs coming into to the world of knowledge than it was the Lutherans and the other Protestants.
What about other areas? We've talked a bit here about cosmology or astronomy. What about the areas of the science of medicine?
Yeah, well, there too you have, again, prominent Christians that brought medicine into play. You have persons like, for example, Paracelsus, a person who lived at the time of Luther, in fact, died only 5 years earlier, lived a relatively short life, often has been called the Luther of medicine, and brought in a lot of medical thoughts, scientific thoughts, that again were seen as contrary, almost heretical, in terms of what is to be done and practiced in the realm of medicine. In addition to that, you had other men that were very prominent in science, or medicine rather. For example, James Simpson, a couple of hundred years later, actually in the 1800s, who brought into the world of medicine the use of chloroform, a devout Christian, and who once, you know, was a physician, I believe, if my memory doesn't fail me, to Queen Victoria. Also, you have Louis Pasteur, whom I mentioned before, who said, "The more I know, the more does my faith approach that of a Breton pheasant, a peasant, I'm sorry." And when he died, as I told you before, his Christian conviction beliefs were evident when he held his crucifix in one hand. You had also, for example, people like William Harvey, Joseph Lister, after whom we name Listerine, that made great advances in medicine. Ambroise Paré, a French physician who, for example, really in many ways transformed surgery, because previous to his time, only barbers performed surgery. And executioners also, by the way. And, you know, this is why the old barber signs used to have a cylindrical white background with a red sort of ribbon, not ribbon, but painted ribbon-like around it. It always was a sign of a barber who would let blood. This is one way that people sometimes were tried to be cured of certain diseases. They even did that with George Washington. Well, Perry also was a guy who very much revolutionized the matter of, well, in his time, when you had a wound and the like, it was cauterized with a hot, red-hot iron. He instead used ligatures to stop the bleeding, in other words, just to tie off the circulation of the blood above the wound. Again, a very devout Christian. He was also one who used an experimental method in terms of treating a badly burned. Say it's a patient was brought to him who had his face very badly scalded. And, of course, in order to use a particular method, he treated one half of the side and not the other side to see whether it would work. Now, that's really the scientific inductive method again. And he found out, for example, in this case it was onion juice that was applied to it. It did work. So, you know, one can go on in terms of medicine. Great contributions were made. And these people, again, were very much imbued with the Christian way of thinking and saw nothing as contradictory or in conflict with the Christian worldview.
Dr. Schmidt, how would you respond to someone who says, this is all very good for the past, and in the past, without a doubt, Christianity has had a beneficial influence on the sciences. But that is not true of the present. In fact, Christianity has lost the ability to influence science because science has become a godless, an entirely godless enterprise.
Well, again, I mean, there are many scientists today, prominent ones, that are very devout Christians, just like some of these men were 300, 400, 500 years ago. Just to recall one off the top of my head, Wernher von Braun, who was head of the space program in this country, was a devout Christian. In fact, as far as I know, he was a Lutheran. And there are many others. And there are scientists who write books defending, for example, the Christian point of view. The only problem is that the universities and colleges seem to be totally ignorant of them and don't want to even look at the other side or the rest of the story, as one can say. So, again, Christianity is not in conflict with science today, and you have many Christians today that are devout, devout scientists and devout Christians. The two are not in conflict.
How much in the American mindset of recent memory did the so-called Scopes monkey trial, how much of a role did it play in driving at least a popularly conceived wedge between science and Christianity?
Probably quite a bit. And again, that point has been sort of exaggerated too. You see, one of the problems we have, and we have it particularly so today, with the sensationalism that is put on the television screen to attract viewers, to titillate people's minds and interests, and not give much information behind it. And so this was in many ways the beginning of the media latching on to certain information and paint Christianity by implication and by inferences rather than direct knowledge or direct conclusions as in a negative light. And that ball has been rolling ever since. And we have often, perhaps even as Christians in universities and Christian colleges, not really done our homework to defend Christianity in terms of what it has done for science. And I want to go back to it again. If it were not for Christianity that posited a rational God who created the world that therefore they concluded could be studied in a rational manner, and that God runs this world by rational laws, and that we as Christians, going all the way back to the Old Testament, were given dominion over the world to understand and analyze it, if you will. All of that ties into the origin of science and the continuation of it. But again, our people today in college, including many of the professors, are very ignorant not only about Christian history, what we're talking about, they're also very ignorant about the Bible. How many times don't we hear about the idea that, for example, laws of gravity, for example, that the earth moves and circulates, for example, around the sun? Well, we have passages in the Bible where it says he hangs the world on nothing. Well, that very much corresponds to the theory of gravitation, again, discovered by Isaac Newton, a pretty down-to-earth Christian who defended the resurrection of Jesus Christ. You know, one can go on.
Finally, and briefly, Dr. Schmidt, when you compare Christianity's influence on science with the influence or lack thereof from non-Christian religions, how does it stack up?
Well, very much so, because, you know, as some Christian philosophers have said, if it weren't for Christianity, science would never come into being, partly because of the pantheistic view, whether it was by Aristotle or whether it was the Hindus, for example, in India. You know, it's very interesting. India developed a decimal point, without which modern math would not be possible. It also really developed what we call the Arabic numeral system. No, it was not the Arabs. The Arabs borrowed it from the Hindus. Yet they did not develop any kind of science. Why? Because they were basically tied down to a pantheistic, pan-emanistic view of the world, which meant that you couldn't, if God was in everything, if you were to study and analyze it rationally as a scientific method requires, you would be analyzing the divine, and that was unthinkable in the ancient pagan world.
20 seconds here, Dr. Schmidt. Well, Dr. Schmidt, thank you very much for being our guest.
Again, my pleasure being with you.
How Christianity Changed the World is going to be one of the topics that Dr. Schmidt is going to be discussing at a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June the 26th through July the 2nd at the Schwann Center in northern Wisconsin, Trago, Wisconsin. I've attended this seminar two times, once as a, we broadcast from there, once as a speaker, and it is greatly beneficial. If you enjoy Issues, etc., the topics, the breadth of topics, and the approach of Issues, etc., then this is the Worldview Seminar for you to attend, June the 26th through July the 2nd at the Schwann Center in Trago, Wisconsin. You can find out more information by going to our website, issuesetc.org. There's a Schwann Center logo right there on our homepage. Click on that and you'll find the information. Or you can call the Schwann Center at 1-800-577-4848. 1-800-577-4848, and ask for the information on this Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar this summer at the Schwann Center in northern Wisconsin. Dr. Alvin Schmidt will be there. Dr. Gene Edward Veith will be there. Dr. Angus Manouge, just to name a few. And there are Issues, Etc. regular guests. 1-800-577-4848. When we come back from this break, I would like your thoughts on Christian children attending public schools. I'm going to tell you my story and how some of my thoughts have begun to change on this issue. And I'd like yours as well. It's open lines for the next hour, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, near the end of that hour, we're going to be joined by Dr. Richard Stuckwish. He's pastor of Emmaus Lutheran Church in South Bend, Indiana. He'll join us because today, and we should not let this pass by, today the church remembers a 4th century bishop called Athanasius. And there can be probably, next to men like St. Augustine, no greater influence on the church than from the teachings and the stalwart faithfulness of men like Athanasius. Then we'll talk about doctrine with Pastor Clement Preuss in the last half hour.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You are listening to Issues, Etc.
How can you tell the difference between worship as an encounter with the triune God and worship as mere human manipulation? How can you tell the difference between preaching that is the living voice of Christ to sinners and preaching that is catering to the felt needs of the masses? When did the church begin measuring its success by the market rather than faithfulness to the message of Christ? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for May is called The Fire and the Staff. It's written by Issues, Etc. regular guest Pastor Clement Preuss. The book is $26.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and look for the book on the homepage. Or to order, call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The book is called The Fire and the Staff by Pastor Clement Preuss, 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Remember the party that used to favor limited government? Some fiscal conservatives and a freshman senator are calling to task what they're now calling the grand old spending party. Stuart Shepard hears their complaints.
Even with Republicans controlling the House, Senate, and White House, we've seen the biggest spending increases since Lyndon Johnson.
Republicans have gone from being the party of small government to being the party of big government.
Stephen Slavinsky is with the Cato Institute, which is among those calling for a return to the basic principles of fiscal conservatism.
The Republicans are, I think, too focused on what they perceive to be the short-term ways to protect the majority status, and that is by keeping government humming along at faster and faster rates in terms of spending.
Veronique DeRougie with the American Enterprise Institute says she's not sure there's a single strategy to bring back restraint, but she can think of a number of ways to start.
Shaming them, showing them the numbers, not allowing them to lie to themselves and to keep telling themselves that they're the party who stands for limited government. I guess this is the only way we have to go about, you know, reforming the way they do things.
Joining the two groups in the call for change was the new senator from Oklahoma, Dr. Tom Coburn. He brings with him a reputation from his days in the House as someone who's not afraid to speak his mind.
Coburn, I think, is one of the people whom, you know, we can count on to actually fight with us on these issues.
Slavinsky is calling for reforms to control spending, including sunset provisions and budget caps. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard.
Slavinsky also says, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, that he hopes the president can find a spending bill worth vetoing, particularly those that throw in more money for programs than even he requested. Bush did not veto a single bill during his first term and proposes increases for many projects. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Here's a happy AM 850 KFUO salute to our day sponsors on this Monday, May 2nd, 2005, Lloyd and Barb Bittner. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO on the occasion of the celebration of their 40th wedding anniversary on May 1st and the 38th baptism of their daughter Wendy on April 30th. Thanks be to God for His many undeserved blessings. Once again, we say thank you to Lloyd and Barb Bittner of Hecker, Illinois.
Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Clement Preuss is the author of our Book of the Month for May, The Fire and the Staff. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this Reformation resource on our website, issuesetc.org, The Fire and the Staff, Lutheran Theology in Practice, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May.
Okay, here we are halfway through Issues Etc. on this Monday. And I've been thinking about talking about this for several weeks. And I'm telling you my story when it comes to public schools. Actually, I have no story to tell when it comes to public schools because I've never had any personal experience as a student in a public school. I am the product of parochial Lutheran schools from the very beginning all the way until they said, you know, don't go to school anymore. You're done. So we're talking about preschool, kindergarten, sixth grade, starting in seventh grade at a Lutheran high school and going all the way until graduation, then going to a Lutheran college for 4 years, then, after graduating, going to a Lutheran seminary for 4 years, and then, in the first few years of my pastoral ministry, spending some time doing postgraduate work after the graduate work of Lutheran seminary. So I have absolutely no personal experience with the public schools. And here in the course of the next hour, from 4:30 to 5:30 on Issues, etc., after my story, I want to tell you about how some of my thoughts on the public schools have changed. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And I want to hear what you think about Christian children attending public schools. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Richard Stuckwish will join us in about 45 minutes to talk about 4th century Bishop of Alexandria, Athanasius. I can think of no one more influential than just a few others in church history than this man. Pastor Clement Preuss will join us for the last half hour of the program to talk about the relationship of doctrine and practice. He's author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, The Fire and the Staff, Lutheran Theology in Practice. It's open lines. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Okay, I distinctly remember a time I was in seventh grade. I was attending, this was my first year as a junior high student at a parochial Lutheran high school in Dallas, Texas. It was the first year of the Lutheran high school, in fact. And I had entered at the seventh grade. What was I, 13, maybe 14 years old? I was there, loving every minute of it. And as a typical teenager, fledgling teenager, my grades began to drop. Now, they'd never been stellar. They really hadn't. I mean, I go look at my my elementary school report cards, and I remember telling people when I was in college, oh, I think when I was in elementary school, I got straight A's and I never studied. Actually, I was just not studying. The straight A's actually were not there. I've actually looked at the report cards from third and second and all the other grades of elementary school, and you might have called me a less than solid B student through those years. Well, that gives you some perspective on the fact that when I was a seventh grader, my grades started to slip. And I remember distinctly going into my bedroom, and I was shaking. I was shaking with fear. Why? Why? Because my father had given me an ultimatum. He had said to me, after seeing my report card from the seventh grade with those slipping grades, either these grades come up, or we're sending you to public school. I went to my room shaking. So fearful of public school was I. Now, my two older brothers had attended parochial elementary school and then gone on to public school in junior high and high school. But I had a picture. It was as if my father had said to me, bring these grades up or we will sentence you to minimum security prison. Yeah, you'll get to come home at night, but it's going to be prison. I feared public school for all the reasons that I hear many Christians talking about public school in a negative light nowadays. A bad education. The curriculum would in no way reinforce what I believed as a Christian. The atmosphere. The students don't care about one another and the teachers don't care about the students. What I pictured was kind of a rougher version of West Side Story. I pictured the playgrounds, you know, the knife fight scene in West Side Story where they're all dancing around trying to cut each other and having a rumble. That's what I pictured every recess being at public school. Of course, my brothers didn't help. They reinforced the picture for me quite a bit. And to me, it was like, you know what the prison population is like? People go in and they come out worse. They go in bad and they come out worse. That's what I thought public school would be. I wouldn't get educated. I'd graduate and basically be transformed into a hoodlum. My dad said, you bring these grades up or I'm sending you to public school. You know, this parochial school is costing me too much money for you to goof off. So quit paying attention to the girls and start paying attention to your grades. And I took his advice. Now, I didn't bring them up to A's. I brought them back up to my less than solid B average, but I brought them up. There was no way in the world that I was going to let my grades slip again because I didn't want to go to public school. It was the last place I wanted to go. If my dad would have said, bring the grades up or I'm sending you to military school, I would have said, well, that would be interesting to try. If he would have said, bring your grades up and I'm sending you to boarding school, I probably would have jumped at the opportunity. 13-year-old boy gets to leave home. But he said, I'm sending you to public school. So there I am, 13 years old, in my bedroom, shaking and quaking for fear that if I don't bring my grades up, I'm going to public school. And for the most part, after being advancing through a parochial school and not having any experience with public school, all of those negative pictures remained in my mind. And to tell you the truth, until very recently, there was very little that I heard from people that did anything but reinforce those negative views. We've all heard the horror stories of what happens in public schools. The bad cases of what happens in public schools. Some of them have been in the news lately, and they make your blood run cold. But of late, at long last, here I'll be 41 next month, against a lifetime of experience and preconceived notions about public schools, My mind has begun to change. Not about all public schools. I still hear the horror stories, just like the rest of you do. So this is where the story picks up. Several months ago, at long last, my wife and I relent. And after my daughter, who's ironically 13 years old and in seventh grade, with no fear of going to public school, has been asking us for years if she could go to public school in our hometown in Illinois, we finally relent and say, fine, we'll do it. I told my wife, I told others when we made this switch from this girl had gone to Lutheran schools her whole life, and now she's going to go to a public school, right in smack dab in the middle of seventh grade. People warned us. Some said, don't do it. Do you know what seventh grade in public school is like? When I told my mom, you know how when you tell your mom something and she doesn't want to tell you that you're being stupid because you're 40 years old and she shouldn't have to say that to a 40-year-old person, but she, by her silence, says it? We're going to take our daughter out of Lutheran school and put her in the public school. My mom, who is not known for her tact, was exercising extreme self-control when she said, oh, are you sure that's a good idea? Now, I know what she meant to say, what she would have said if she wasn't trying to restrain herself. She would have said, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. She didn't say, do you think that's a good idea? My father, similarly, he's more known for his tact, unlike his son, said, well, I guess it's worth a try. Are you having trouble paying for it, son? That's what he said. His first conclusion was, are you having trouble paying for it? Because, you know, if that's the problem, I could hear him, like, shuffling in his back pocket to get out the checkbook. You know, you just tell me where to write the check, and we can keep that girl in the Lutheran school. No, Dad, that's not it. This has been a long time coming. We've decided finally, as she has been asking us again and again, to go to public school, we're going to let her. I did not expect my mind to change. I still pictured West Side Story playgrounds with kids dancing around with knives in their hands, snapping their fingers. All the cool kids were out there rumbling. I pictured classrooms where the teachers didn't care, where the students didn't care about each other. But lo and behold, after several months here, coming to the end of her seventh grade year, the last 3 months spent in public school, my mind has changed. I think, I dare say, that with very few exceptions, all my preconceived notions about public school and everything that I have been hearing and sometimes saying on these airwaves, at least in our case, has been proved absolutely wrong and false. Now, I want to know what you think about sending Christian kids to public schools. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Am I wrong? Have I been duped by the state educational system into believing that it's a good thing rather than a bad thing? I will say, the school system where my daughter now attends is probably one of the better public school systems there is out there. It really is. It's great. Am I wrong in this? I want to hear from you. I know you have an opinion. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Did we make a mistake? And you know, and the whole deal was, we'll try this for 3 months. If we have reservations about it, you're back in Lutheran school. If you have reservations about it, obviously, young daughter, we're not going to make you stay there. She's already talking about going not only to eighth grade, but to public high school, too. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Well, there's my story. You could not have found someone more fearful, more wary, more cautious, more believing of all the typical things you hear about public schools than me. And at least in my case, and I cannot speak for anyone else, my mind has changed. We start with Bill in Los Alamos, New Mexico. He listens on the internet. Bill, thank you for calling.
Yes. Todd, we went through exactly the same problem that you went through, except our children were homeschooled. And my oldest daughter, who was apparently the same age as yours, attempted to go to seventh grade for about 3 weeks, beginning of this year. What happened was it was eye-opening for both her and us. It wasn't the classes, it wasn't the schoolwork, that was none of the problem, aside from the fact that she had a lot of trouble being able to do all the homework she was required to do.
Oh, yeah.
But the biggest problem, from my point of view, and the stories are still leaking out, are the kinds of things that go on there. And I think it might depend on the kind of person that goes there. My daughter in particular has become enthralled with what's called punk. And this bothers me, but I don't know what to do about it other than talk about it with her. And so what she found at the junior high was a lot of kissing, grabbing, things that I would have thought outrageous. We would have been thrown off the campus. The kids would have been beating them up if they did the kind of things that apparently go on in junior high. Now, I went to junior high. Well, I didn't go to junior high, but in the 50s. And so things apparently have changed a lot. There's a lot of drug usage. And this stuff she both finds sort of disturbing, at the same time appealing, because it seems sort of punkish to her. So I don't think she's ready. She had to drop out after 3 weeks because she was going to have an emotional breakdown. If she didn't, we would, because she could not possibly keep up with all the work she was asked to being done, at least what she thought she was being asked to do.
Now, Bill, is she back to homeschooling again?
She is back, and we're talking about putting her in next year. I am opposing that and decided that I think it's wiser to wait for high school.
All right, Bill, thank you very much. Now, Bill's talking about his own situation here, and I understand those kind of situations as well. You know, those are the things running through my mind. You got your drugs, you got your sex, you got your humanistic philosophy, you got this evolution being shoved down their throats. Sally calls from her car. Sally, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Tad. I've had both situations, parochial and public school, with more than one child in different settings. And what I'll say about high school is that there's drugs and sex at the parochial schools as well as the public schools.
No doubt.
I think a lot of it has to do with the child themselves. And the other thing with your daughter is you're still in the honeymoon. I'd give her, let's see what next year brings. Because I found for my one child that switched that it was the first few months was still kind of fun and new, and then after about a year, well, and then you get to things like when the school choir competition is at Sunday morning and it's required to attend or your grade is docked, and arguing with the teachers over that, you know, they don't have my kids 7 days a week, but they think they do.
You know, that was, but thank you, Sally. I ran into exactly the same kind of mindset, however, in parochial schools in my own experience, my own personal experience, where there were expectations put upon as a student, I wasn't quite sure whether I belonged first to my parents or to these teachers. And I found that in the parochial school as well. And you're right, Sally. You want to find drugs and sex, you can find it in any parochial high school, any place. In fact, the difference is, generally speaking, the kids have more money and they can afford it. And they all have their own car. If any place, it's easier at the parochial school, generally speaking. Dee calls from her car. Dee, welcome.
Hi. I'm a mother and grandmother. I had four children, three of which went to public school. And because of our horrible experiences with all three kids in public schools, different areas of the United States and overseas, we're a military family. We decided to homeschool our youngest, and that was the best decision we'd ever made. And now that my youngest daughter, whom we homeschooled, is a mom, we've talked about education for her child, and I'm a parent, grandparent, who is willing to pay for Lutheran schools, and I'm not Lutheran, I'm Presbyterian, but in looking at all of the school systems, I have found that the Lutheran schools seem to teach better, and there's a better setting that's going to reinforce Christianity as opposed to the public schools, which are very anti-Christian and very anti-God. And I just have watched the behavior of most public school children. They're extremely immature, rude, have no respect for themselves or other people, and that can happen in parochial schools as well, but I've not seen it be as flagrant as with the ones in public school. So as a grandparent and a Christian, I don't believe that I would be able to put a child or a grandchild into the public school system any longer.
Dee, thank you for the call. Okay, so there's a lack of maturity that she sees there among some of the kids who come out of the public school system. And she speaks from a long experience. Mark's up next. He calls from his car. Mark, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pastor. Thanks for taking my call. I was just curious on your daughter. You mentioned that she wanted to go to the public school. What was the thought process, why that was so appealing? And I guess also the question for you is, if your daughter's in seventh grade, how much decision-making authority do you give a child that's in seventh grade?
None. It was my decision. It was my decision 100%. In fact, I didn't even give any to my wife. My wife actually had gone to both parochial and public school off and on. She's a pastor's kid. They moved a lot. Her experience in the parochial schools, especially in the upper grades, was uniformly negative. Her experience in the public schools, and she went to a very good one, was very positive. But she didn't, she said, look, you know, it's a matter of principle. We all said we like to continue the Christian education. So in answer to your last question there, Dave, I think the name was, this was not her decision to make. This was my decision to make, Mark. And I take a complete responsibility for the decision. It's still my decision to make. And will remain so. What was the attraction for her? Well, without going into too many details, I'll put it this way, as I've said to many people. My daughter will be climbing Mount Everest someday because it's there. And what she saw in the public schools was a broader horizon, a bigger challenge. Her philosophy in life does seem to be, in the best way possible, been there, done that. I am ready now to be challenged a little bit more. And without going into any other details that I wouldn't want to say on the air, that was basically the thinking. And just to set your heart at ease, Mark, lest you think I shirk my parental duties, this was a request that she put in with us when she was in the fourth grade. Sandy calls from St. Louis. Sandy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Oh, I heard a noise. I went to the public school all my life, was in a small town, and it was fine. But I work with some girls who are in St. Louis in the West County schools, and the stories I hear are just amazing. And I think, with the fighting, the knives that get brought to school, even a girls' volleyball team, they were playing, and the other team said, oh, if you win, we're going to get you in the locker room. Sure enough, there was, you know, stitches had to be taken to the hospital, all kinds of stuff. But I think the one thing, I know the town that you're talking about where your daughter goes to school, and I wouldn't be as afraid because of the town. St. Louis, I would probably be a little fearful because my kids are in a parochial school. But I think it depends, you know, what kind of area you're in as to what, you know, you're really going to experience as much as other places. So I want to throw that out there because, I was in a small town, too, and it was okay. But some areas where there's busing and all, it just seems to be really out of hand.
Sandy, thank you for the call. Now, see, that's exactly... I'll be honest with you. That's why I say I can only speak for my situation. I can only speak for this experience and this change of mind that I've undergone here from the perspective that from this experience. If it would have been one of the city schools, I seriously doubt I would have let my daughter go. I've heard the same stories. And notice... we're not talking inner city schools here. We're talking, she said, West County. Drive out to West County sometime. Try to find a house that's under 3,500 square feet. These are the most privileged of the privileged children of the Midwest. Okay, so I understand that, too. And, yes, I said that at the outset. Largely, it might be this town, this school district. What do the rest of you think? 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Bryce calls from Colorado. He listens on the Internet. Bryce, thank you for calling.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing up this topic. This is fascinating. My two daughters were in Lutheran school. One, the youngest till fourth grade and the oldest till eighth grade. We pulled them out the same year. And for us, it's been a complete positive experience. We found the teachers in the public schools to be more competent and more caring than the students in the Lutheran schools. And, in our Lutheran system out here, there's just a whole bunch of just rampant pietism, and the types of teaching they would get at the Lutheran school was just not, I didn't think it was that helpful for their spiritual life, really.
Bryce.
And, yeah.
What, you had something else you wanted to say?
Yeah, and it's for my youngest daughter particularly. Her spiritual walk is just a lot stronger than it's that's ever been, stronger than my older daughter, who had more contact with the Lutheran school. And so I'm sure it's different in different situations, but for us it has been overwhelmingly positive experience. And
sounds like a parallel situation to ours. In fact, I talked to somebody before we made this decision. I talked to someone who had done precisely what we were thinking about doing, which was pull the kid out of a parochial school in the city and put him in a public school in a small town. And I remember this couple saying to me, it was at a church I was preaching at, and they said, best decision we ever made. Best decision we ever made. Grades came up. Attitude changed. The child now succeeds in school, and it has been a positive situation. As a net, a positive situation. And I'm thinking back to where was all this fear about the public school system, and I'm only speaking from my experience, where was this instilled in me, and why is it, do you think it might be that Christians, taking into account all of the horror stories that you do here, paint with a very broad brush when it comes to the dangers of public school, and extrapolate from the worst case scenarios, which certainly do exist, to every scenario? Because you know that the public school system, state-run schools, have become, in many ways, the whipping boy for Christianity and our social commentary. What do you think? More of your phone calls after this break. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.